I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Florida-born author and journalist T.D. Allman's book, Miami, City of the Future, celebrates its 25th anniversary with an updated reprint. T.D. joins us in the studio to look back at Miami's tumultuous past for insight into its future and lessons for other Florida cities like Orlando.
You know, I do not deny the tragic nature of history. In both my books, especially the second one, Finding Florida, I say you cannot understand yourself, you cannot understand Florida, you cannot understand America, unless you have a tragic sense of history.
A conversation with Miami, City of the Future and Finding Florida, the True History of the Sunshine State author, T.D. Allman. But first, Senate President Don Gates says child welfare reform is a major priority for him this legislative session. The Republican from Panama City used his opening session speech to talk about new reports of child abuse, neglect and death that occurred under the watch of the State Department of Children and Families. 90.7's Amy Kiley speaks to Florida State Senator Gates about a package of reform bills in the legislature this session to address these issues. That's ahead on Intersection. Senate President Don Gates is making child welfare reform a priority this session. He recently spoke with 90.7's Amy Kiley to explain why.
Why do you think our child welfare system is suffering the reported abuse and deaths, and what about the issue got your attention?
More than 430 child fatalities with allegations of maltreatment have occurred in the last 5 years. And when you have 430 children who are, broadly speaking, within the scope of the Department of Children and Families, and they're either missing or they're dead, there's a problem. And it seems to me that the state, even in the most conservative government, ought to have some responsibility for protecting the most vulnerable among us. And children who are involved in the child welfare system through no fault of their own, they're sort of there as happenstance victims, need to be protected better than the state of Florida has protected them.
Why do lawmakers want to make reform a legal matter when the interim DCF secretary has already proposed internal voluntary changes?
The interim DCF secretary has made some excellent proposals in response to media stories, and also in response to the good work of a bipartisan group of Florida senators who have been raising this issue. But interim DCF secretaries come, and unfortunately, they go. And our laws and the protections that we give to our children, especially the most vulnerable children, can't depend upon who the interim DCF secretary is or how hard the biscuits were in the office one morning. It's got to depend upon legal standards that we establish that are understandable, that the courts can use, that local officials can fully appreciate to make sure that we have a consistent standard of protection across the state that doesn't depend upon who might happen to sit in what office at any given point in time.
Neil Skeen's white paper on this criticizes restrictive rules instead of common sense. And since laws are rules, how can legislators overcome that catch-22?
Well, I think that Mr. Skeen's paper was an extraordinarily well thought out analysis of what's wrong and what ought to be done. And that's why our bipartisan coalition in the Senate is not just proposing a set of laws, but rather a set of standards. First of all, making sure that we enhance the qualifications of the people who are working in the child welfare system by making sure that we have degreed social workers, that we have individuals to fill the positions who actually know how to use the referral systems and pull in all of the resources necessary to help protect a child. And secondly, part of our package is a mandate and initiative to tap the knowledge of experience of our child welfare experts in Florida's universities by creating an institute within our universities to research best practices in child welfare, to analyze policy and performance now and in the future, and to develop leaders who will improve the child welfare system continuously. It's setting a standard, it's passing tough laws, it's making sure that there's a performance requirement, but then it's making sure that the resources, both human and material and sort of an infrastructure of knowledge, is put together to back up the laws that we pass.
So Skeen, in his white paper and then in the certification bill that I think you were just referencing, it's calling for hiring and retaining smart, effective workers, which it seems like every organization would like and doesn't always get. So how is it not pie in the sky this time, but a possible reality?
Well, it's one thing to say, let's hire qualified people. It's another thing to provide the resources to make sure that we can hire qualified people. So part of the plan that we have developed, working closely between the House and the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, is to put millions of dollars of extra money into hiring people who are truly qualified. You get what you pay for so often in the private sector as well as in the public sector. So you can't just establish a standard of performance and then hope it works. You have to put the dollars in to train, to educate, to hire, and to supervise the kind of professionals you need who actually will know how to pull resources in, to make referrals, to advocate for children, to make sure that the system works, to make sure the kids don't disappear and die.
Speaking of dollar signs, why haven't we been getting matching funds from the Federal Fostering Connections Act, and will the new legislation take care of that?
I'm not familiar with the Federal Fostering Care Act's requirements for the state. I can tell you that the commitment that we're making here in Florida is to use state dollars to spend more money to hire the right people to perform in a way that I think will establish a higher standard.
I'm looking at the list of bills in the Senate and the House. Which of these do you think has the most support in either chamber, and what would those bills accomplish?
Well, I think the bills would accomplish the points that we've talked about. First, setting a standard of performance. Secondly, ensuring better coordination between the local agencies, what are called the community-based agencies, and the state and the court system. Then third, hiring the right people and paying them a salary that's a living wage, and then establishing best practices in a university-based institute, and those best practices then being applied to what goes on in the field. All of this is designed to make sure we just don't lose kids, and that those who are responsible for children in the child welfare system are held accountable. I don't believe that one of these bills is better than the other. I think the package of bills are necessarily held together by an integral commitment to reform the system that's losing too many children. And I believe that given the support that we've had from the House and the Senate and Democrats and Republicans, that we'll pass this legislation and it'll become law.
And one of the things that Skeen talked about in his paper was avoiding a culture of blame. But I know some of this legislation requires investigation, and the reports that began some of this talk required investigation. How do you look into a matter as lawmakers, as administrators, whatever, without placing blame and paralyzing workers with fear?
Well, I think what Neil Skeen talked about was a culture of blame where all you're doing is finding fault and not curing the problem. That's to be avoided at all costs, I think. But frankly, when you have 400 children disappear or die tied directly or indirectly to the child welfare system, there has to be accountability. Accountability is the first step toward remedying a problem, finding out what went wrong, diagnosing the weaknesses in the system, and then fixing them. So I think just blaming people won't get the job done, but finding out where the weaknesses are and remedying those weaknesses with better laws, with better coordination, and more resources is essential.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
You bet. Thank you so much, Amy.
That was 90.7's Amy Kiley speaking with Florida State Senate President Don Gates. Up next, a conversation with journalist and author T.D. Allman about his book, Miami, City of the Future. I'm joined in the studio by T.D. Allman. He's an author and journalist. He's released a 25th anniversary revised edition of his 1987 book, Miami, City of the Future. T.D., welcome back to the program.
It's wonderful to be back.
Now, you wrote the book and published it originally 25 years ago. Why did you decide to revisit this volume?
Because Miami is important, and the book, I will honestly say, is of continuing importance. People throughout it, I think it was the best-selling nonfiction book in Florida for several years, not just the Miami area. And people say to me, it reads today as it did back then. And I wrote a foreword and an afterword. And, you know, there's a big connection between Miami and Orlando, which perhaps we might discuss. But it was time also not only to note what made Miami and what it was and why it's significant, but how it's changed in the national image. I've written an entirely new foreword and afterword, which really bring up the current state of understanding of urban affairs and what we're becoming demographically as a country. And I call that opening foreword from pariah to paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about a lot, especially in the first part of the book, about Miami Vice and how that sort of created an image of Miami that was either, you know, rightly or wrongly, people associated that with the city, and it kind of delves into the what was something of a drug culture in the city at the time.
Yeah, I think we could charitably call it something of a drug culture. But first of all, let me say one of the interesting things, and I bring this out in both my Florida books, is the popular culture, Hollywood, music, TV, frequently gets things faster, better, and more accurately than the press, the politicians, and the academics do. And what Miami Vice hit all those years ago was suddenly there were these entirely new categories of people who did not belong to the old category, so that we in America started from our history, which is either you were white, you were black, or you weren't American, or you were an Indian and had to go live out on a reservation. And one of my favorite characters from Florida history, as you know, is Zephaniah Kingsley, a noble figure who in the 1820s publicly proposed that the solution to alleviating race hatred and hence implicitly avoiding a civil war was interracial sex between the white race and the black race. And, of course, in the end, Zephaniah Kingsley has been proven right. Go to any mall or food court, let alone a trendy club here in Orlando or in Miami or anywhere else, and you see all these wonderfully intelligent, bright people who don't fit into the old categories.
Let me ask you, too, about, you know, the start of the story and the start of Miami's story, the way it's portrayed in this book, it's fairly bleak. You talk about race riots, desperate immigrants. What kind of lasting impact did these events have on the city of Miami?
Well, again, remember, one of the things, the point I make over and over again is Miami's resilience. And so whether it's Hurricane David or Hurricane Ilian, after a couple of years, Miami picks itself up, dusts itself off, though it would be mud in this case, and it starts the whole frenzy all over again. And we're actually now in another building boom in Miami. I don't know who's going to buy all these things. But what I love about Miami, and which you also have in Orlando now, is this wonderful diversity and hope. You know, people come to America. They don't come to America because they've analyzed the facts of history. They come to America because America is a beacon of hope. And, you know, I've seen it happen with the Hispanics and with the Haitians and with many others in Miami. Even the Marielitos, who most, you know, they weren't entirely, but many of them were criminals. In about 10 years, they go from having nothing to I have what I describe as the little house with the big car outside. And then their kids move to the big house with a big swimming pool outside. And that escalator still works. Now, the question surrounding us now in our whole national debate, which Miami raised then and raised now, is how long can this go on in a society that in traditional terms produces less and less, consumes more and more, and which, you know, was absolutely unbelievable when I was growing up as a child, had such an extraordinarily and growing inequality of wealth. Now, when I was growing up, even before high school, the thing we were taught, what made America great was the great American middle class. We had some rich people and some poor people, but basically everybody had the same thing. Now, of course, that was false even at the time, but there was an enormous amount of truth to it. So Miami is the place to watch for that. When I called it Miami City of the Future, everybody was so excited because they, like most Americans, equate the future with better. Well, I think Miami is now on the way to really being the city of the future climate change is upon us.
Mm-hmm. Are there other cities, though, in Florida perhaps that might have supplanted or maybe even picked up a little bit on that spirit of hope from Miami?
Well, I think what happens at the end, I do not deny the tragic nature of history in both my books, especially the second one, Finding Florida. I say you cannot understand yourself, you cannot understand Florida, you cannot understand America unless you have a tragic sense of history. That said, I don't see a competition among the major American cities. But what I do see is that Orlando, at a certain point, thought it could be Disney America, blonde, blue-eyed forever. And, that's not impossible. That's impossible. Today, it has a very high crime rate, as you know. I managed to get through your freeway system, but I want to tell you, when I'm in L.A., I have no problems there, but Orlando befuddles me. And so you have a lot of problems here. But what you also have, which none of the people who thought they were escaping... See, back in 1980, they had these silly sayings like, will the last American bring the flag? Florida, Miami really isn't a part of America. No, no, no. Florida was the future of America. Today, there are more Hispanics in Kansas than there are in Miami, when there were in Miami when I wrote the book. And look at Orlando now, and let me underline how much better it is today because of all these foreigners coming in. They come from places as weird as New Zealand, but we have Vietnamese in Orlando. You have the wonderful Indian, especially the South Indian influence. You have the Puerto Rican.
The Vietnamese have been here for quite some time.
Yes, that's true. But they have grown and, to become important parts of the mosaic.
I'm Matthew Petty. You're listening to Intersection. I'm speaking with Florida author and journalist T.D. Allman. You can join the conversation online on Facebook or tweet us at WMFE Orlando, or you can email us at intersection@WMFE.org. Let's talk a little, too, about the transportation, the kind of infrastructure around that, because there's an image at the start of this book where you talk about driving on the freeway and sort of driving over the top of Liberty City.
Yes.
And looking down on it. And transportation has played a pretty big role in just sort of shaping some of these cities, like Miami, as you say, was kind of dug out of the ocean pretty much. You talk about the train lines, the private train lines, the likes of Flagler and Sanford and other rail barons. We are, and we talked about this last time too, we are kind of returning in some ways to that era of transportation and somewhat of a boom in infrastructure. How do you see this playing out over the next 20, 30 years?
Well, it's interesting because while in Orlando, I shall talk about Orlando in the future. And unfortunately, I've come to the conclusion that Orlando and perhaps Miami, never will have an effective public transportation system. There should be one. Somehow the vested interests in keeping things as they are always seem to prevail. I mean, and, you talk about Disney. Downtown Orlando starts to revive. What they build a new theme park called Downtown Disney. I have not researched this, but I understand various enterprises have consistently thwarted a high-speed rail link between the theme park area in the downtown. I'm not saying that as a fact. You're the experts here. But as long as our public transportation, as long as we don't have leadership, sufficient leadership and authority to do these things, we're going to have incremental adjustments, grudging adjustments, both to the increasing strangeness of the land around us as water levels rise and salinity increases, and also as energy costs go up. And I think, where I do see change is in, I will call it grudging technological accommodation. I mean, you can buy a car today that gets 50 miles to the gallon. I think the first car I drove when I was a teenager got less than 10 miles to the gallon. So these things do happen. I suppose as an intellectual, albeit one who has partied in Miami and sniffed cocaine a long time ago once, I keep – whenever I write a book, I think people will read it and say, oh, my heavens, now we understand. And yet what I describe in all my books is that people don't respond to existential challenges that way. So I would like to say that in 20 years, Orlando, what I call the Central Florida megapolis, will have a functioning rail system, public transportation. But I just don't see it happening, to be honest with you.
You write, too, with some affection about Miami Airport, and this is 25 years ago. Have things changed since then?
Well, I'm not sure I have. I didn't have to fly so much back then in and out. But, yes, I think the airports, all our airports, are a wonderful place to look at what we really are and where we're going. The other wonderful place to go is go to any Florida driver license bureau. And there you see in a hundred, well, I'm speaking metaphorically, in dozens of languages, nervous parents speaking in Malayalam, Hindi, Farsi, Spanish, Portuguese, Slovenian to their teenage kids who've already become Americanized and don't want their parents to tell them, in the fear. And that moment, which is related to what we were just talking about, the sense and mostly now the illusion of freedom which getting behind the wheel of a car gives you. So, I mean, this is as much a part of America now as guns, obviously.
It's still a pretty big part of American culture. The car culture is strong, even though there are, as you say, incremental changes towards public transportation in some cities, which, like Orlando, haven't had a great system in the past.
And, you know, one of the things, and, you know, I'm not an idealist, I'm a realist, but I remember some years ago I was doing a story on Cheney for Rolling Stone magazine, and every ex-CIA agent or
had You're referring to the former vice president.
Yes, had an op-ed in his desk drawer in the suburbs of Washington saying the Iraq invasion was a mistake, which the Washington Post, run by my Harvard classmate Donnie Graham, refused to run because they thought they could get cozy with the Republicans and that would solve their problems, which it did not, as we know. And the further I went out, sometimes I had to go all the way to West Virginia. And, you know, you see how cheap money, cheap mortgage rates, and cheap petrol, cheap energy rates have devastated the countryside of America. And it is, you know, I have to say I live in New York most of the time. And, you know, I have a country house in the Hudson Valley. I get there 65 minutes by train. I don't keep a car in the city. I never have. And there is something wonderful about not having a millstone, a 2-ton or 3-ton millstone around you. Where do I park it? And so on. But it's not just America. I also live in France, as you know. And you have to have a car in rural France now. The myth of the European transport system is a myth. And, you know, the nearest convenient rail station to me is like 20 miles away. And there, theoretically, there's a bus once a day to someplace. So it is a very interesting question. Now, the other thing, I was in China since we last met. And, I mean, I drove from – I was in Sichuan, which used to be the back of the beyond. They built a – in 3 years, they built a 2,000-mile freeway, mostly unmarked, going across all these mountains. And you're driving on it with the trucks and the fumes and the pollution. You see, these societies, India, China, the others – they did have a chance to build an affluent society on something other than the motor car. But the motor cars, it's just tied up with freedom. You know, once people get rich enough, they want the car, they want to vote, they want to say what they want. And it's up to us somehow in the 21st century to try and make the best of this entangling situation. If we don't, nothing much is going to happen except we will be overcome by events. Climate change is going to occur in Florida whether we do anything or not. The only question is, do we respond to this in a way, in a more intelligent way, or do we simply not respond to it at all? And that, the other point I would like to make about, I think it's very good that we recycle our plastic and all this stuff, and that's important. And we use automobiles that get better mileage and so on. But, you know, in 1940 was the first time that the population of Florida exceeded 1 million. It was today it's nearing 20 million, about the same population as Australia. When you put nearly 20 million people on a relatively small peninsula with no natural resources, you've already made all your environmental decisions. You've made all your major environmental decisions.
Well, you talk about a second boom in Florida, too, going back to the 1950s and 60s with the Disney development in Central Florida. And also the growing community on the Space Coast. I want to talk about that a little bit, too. I mean, while Disney was building his fantasy land to attract tourists from other parts of the country, there was also kind of a real-life fantasy coming true on the Space Coast with the space race. Talk a little bit about
all right,
that.
Absolutely. But you see, the difference is that Disney was pioneering the paradigm of a post-industrial service sector global economy in which tourism is the single biggest industry. nothing happened on the Space Coast for a number of reasons. Partly politics, a lot of the stuff went to Houston, California. Another reason is Florida's never had a strong record in education. But the third thing, and I really want to say this, I don't see why we should glamorize NASA. The human species is no more meant to go into, you know, extraterrestrial space than goldfish are meant to drive cars. You know, we evolved under certain circumstances. Our genius is to be able to use tools and implements to send. And one of the points I make in this book in Miami, which I made so long ago, which I continue to make in various ways, is one of the founding and most pernicious myths of Florida is that it never gets cold in Florida. I just came from the panhandle. I can tell you it's always cold up there, and it frequently gets cold here, as you know. But, you know, it was cold. It was the myth that it never gets cold in Florida that killed the astronauts. I won't go into the O-rings here, which caused the explosion and so on, which I describe in both books.
And you're talking about Challenger.
Yes, I am. But more than that, it's this whole idea, a fallacious idea, as a matter of fact, that America was founded by pioneers. That would be a whole other program. But so I think what happened, you see, in Central Florida, Orlando became the family vacation theme park center of the universe. And nothing much happened on the so-called Space Coast, except it got a funny, you know, a name. And but like a lot of things in Florida, it was largely dependent on federal spending, of course.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one more question, T.D. Ullman. Just back to your previous comment about traveling through West Virginia and looking at the sprawl and the effects of low mortgage rates, low gas, et cetera. Are cities the way of the future? Do you think we're going to see a retreat to the cities out of the countryside?
Well, yes. Our urban future, you see it all over the world. Again, so I hope somebody calls it and corrects me. Let us suppose there are 35 provinces in the Republic of the Philippines. I cannot remember the number. 20 of them, or maybe 25 of them, now have fewer people than they did at independence as people converge on Manila and other large cities. They have what they call the French desertification, where everybody moves to Paris or the Riviera. What we have emerging here is what in Finding Florida, but in Miami also, I describe as the Central Florida megapolis. And it's all this conurbation that you're talking about is now one of the world's emerging great cities. By great, I simply mean size. It's up to all of you to decide whether it's a great city. And that's fascinating to watch. And have you noticed, I could make an argument that Orlando is to today what Miami was 25 years ago. Everything, you know, this is the area. You who live along the I-4 corridor, you now decide who is the president of the United States. If we have silly laws, pernicious laws that allow people to kill others and not pay any penalty for it, it somehow seems to happen here or nearby. So you're living in a fascinating place. I have no advice to you except you're on your own. Take responsibility for your own actions. Don't build your house on top of a sinkhole. Acquire knowledge and try and hold your public officials and yourself accountable for what goes on around you.
T.D. Ullman, it's been a pleasure speaking to you again. We've been speaking to T.D. Ullman, who's the author of Miami City, the Future. It's now out in a reprint. Thank you very much for coming in.
Always an honor to be with you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.